Welcome to MIT Talks. I'm Vita Bilkis.
And I'm Dana Attar. MIT Talks set out to bring you the stories that shape the people of MIT.
And I'm Sarah Trace. As the co-hosts of MIT Talks, we go behind the scenes with some of the most influential members of the MIT community, past and present, to dig deeper into their unique and inspiring journeys.
So tune in, listen, learn, and grow.
This is MIT Talks.
On this episode of MIT Talks, we are speaking with Angelique Adams, 2018 Executive MBA from Sloan. We'll hear about her insights into being a woman in STEM, the challenges, and the triumphs. Hi, Angelique. Thank you so much for joining us on MIT Talks.
Thanks for having me.
So I've done quite a bit of research on you, but I'm hoping maybe you can take a minute and just fill our listeners in on your professional journey and what brought you to MIT.
Sure. So I have 25 years of experience in metals and mining. I'm an engineer, and most of that time I've spent in research and development and operations. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I really got interested in learning more about product development. So prior to that, I was doing process improvement. And so I thought, okay, well, a way to do that would be to get my MBA. I was, of course, looking at all the different places where I could go. MIT is known for innovation. So I thought that MIT would be a great place for me to try to get my MBA. And then, of course, they have the added benefit of not requiring the GMAT. So that was a total plus. So that's what led me to MIT, really wanting to get some experience on the product development and really understanding the methodologies behind innovation.
Excellent. And I'm sure you were successful at getting all the things you came to MIT for.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And then after MIT, what was your journey since then?
Yeah, so after MIT, I did leave the company I was at for 20 years, which was a huge change for me. It was a company called Alcoa, an aluminum company, and I moved to a different metal, to stainless steel and alloys. I moved to a different country. I moved to France from the US and became the chief innovation officer of a company called Operum. And that is almost entirely product development. So I definitely got what I was looking for in terms of getting more of the business side of things, more interface with the customer, and developing new products.
Excellent, excellent. And as a fellow graduating EMBA, I am sure, no doubt, that you have some really interesting stories to tell about your time in the program. I think one of them that resonated most with me and subsequently led to the publishing of a book is an experience that you describe in one of the women's programs that is part of the EMBA program. Can you maybe take our listeners to that moment of where you had this kind of thought that led to the book?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, we had a very robust and active women's group in the EMBA program. We would meet weekly when we were in residency and share our experiences. And we decided at one point to have a mixed gender group and discuss about issues of gender diversity in the workforce. And during that meeting, there were several women that raised their hand and spoke up about challenges of imposter syndrome and other things that happened. And some of the men raised their hand and said, you know, we have those challenges too. And for whatever reason, the women in the group really were strongly wanting to say, no, you don't understand. It's much harder for us as women. And I remember thinking at that time, well, I agree it can be harder for us. I think we missed an opportunity to have a place where we can both share empathy, where we can both talk about these experiences, where we're having low points and see if we can work together to make improvements. And so I didn't say anything at this meeting, and it was unusual for me not to say anything at these meetings. And so a couple of my classmates came back to me and said, why weren't you active in this discussion? And I said, you know, I really think we missed an opportunity, and it really didn't resonate with my own experience. So they said, well, you should speak up about your own experience because, you know, I think you have a lot to say. And I thought, well, I don't know that I really want to do that. But then over time, they kept encouraging me. And I said, well, okay, if I'm going to share my experience, I feel like I want to share the experience of other women also. And so that really led to me wanting to write this book that talks not only about my experiences, but I've interviewed dozens of other women and wrote what our experiences are like in highly male-dominated industries, which is maybe something a little bit unique to me.
So your book, You're More Than a Diversity Hire, Women in STEM, I've had the opportunity to read quite a bit of it. And being a woman in STEM myself, I was actually so disappointed that this book was not available to me when I started out on my career, because there's so many checklists and like really thoughtful things to think through as you approach this as a woman. And I'm curious, you mentioned a story of a time you had in your own career where you really were challenged with being a woman in STEM, and it was quite an unpleasant experience. And I'm wondering if you could share that with our listeners too, and kind of what you took with that learning and how you've moved forward with it.
Sure. Yeah. I had an experience fairly recently in my career at my previous place of work where, you know, I was in my performance review. I had hit all my metrics. We were discussing my performance. Everything was great. And then at the very end, my boss just said, oh, by the way, I've decided that I'm not going to have you presenting in any of the leadership team meetings because I'm more attractive than you are. And it was such an unreal experience to me. It really felt like I had slammed into a wall, because what I thought about in that exact moment was, okay, I've designed my whole entire career and had huge and fast success by exceeding the metrics, by overperforming. And here, someone is going to hold me back for something that has nothing to do with my performance, but not only that, my appearance. And I really struggled with that. Then I struggled with how to react to it. So at the time, all I did was leave, say, okay, thank you, and leave. I was in Canada. I live in Tennessee. So I took 3 flights home, cried through all 3 of them, just had the wherewithal to tell my husband before he picked me up at the airport, look, I've been crying for the past 6 hours. So just be aware of that. And then, you know, okay, well, when I got home, trying to just figure out, do I tell HR? Do I not tell HR? What do I do? I decided not to tell HR, which then led to months of what kind of women leader am I if I can't even stick up for myself? And so the shame associated with that. So it really turned into probably a 2-year crisis for me that really had me kind of withdraw within myself and become a much smaller version of myself. And I didn't tell anyone. But then I told the women in the MBA program. And that sort of released this, this sort of blanket of shame that I had. And then I realized that once I told them, not only did it make me feel better, but it drew people to me, because this sort of being willing to talk about vulnerability, being willing to talk about the truth, really brought women towards me. And that's when I thought, okay, not only am I going to start talking about this more, but I'm actually going to write about that and the other experiences that I've had, because I know women are having these experiences too. And we just have to find a way to talk about those in a safe way so that we can overcome them together.
Yeah, it's a really delicate topic. And I think it's really hard for women to know exactly what to do in these moments, right? Especially if you're very high up in your career, you don't want to make waves.
Exactly.
I'm curious now that since you've had so many opportunities to speak with so many talented women out there, and also you've had time to reflect, what would you tell your younger self at this moment, had you come to yourself knowing what you know now, of how to navigate something like that?
What I would tell my younger self is to just be kind to myself, because there is no right way to handle something like that. I mean, there is no graceful way to handle situations that we should never be put in the first place. And so rather than beat myself up for what I chose to do because of, as you said, this really complex calculus of my career and I need the money. I mean, there's a bunch of things, but it wasn't right, and I need to defend other women. It's a really complex issue. So whatever you choose to do is okay. And just be kind to yourself, because you made the right decision in the moment, and just move on. And so I wish I had done that rather than waste so much time hiding it and being ashamed.
So more of trusting yourself for the decision that you made.
Absolutely.
At the time. Yeah, I think that's very good advice. And so you've had a obviously super successful career as being a woman in STEM, right? From these higher ranking positions to now writing this new book, which is giving you tons of visibility. So I'm curious, like looking back, what do you think were some of the key decisions you made along the way or the contributing factors that really impacted kind of your career path?
Yeah, I would say two things. So one is how I grew up. So I'm an Army brat. I moved around every 3 years. I'm just used to being dropped in a new environment and figuring out how to navigate it. So having to relocate for jobs, I mean, even the most recent one, France, you know, it was like, oh, you want to move to France for a new job? Sure, why not? I'll figure out how to make it work. And I have. So that part about being able to orient myself in a new environment and being self-reliant in doing that has served me well. The other thing that has served me well is really raising my hand to become a manager and leader early on. And that's for two reasons. One, it is really what I love. I mean, I love the people side of innovation and leading other people and inspiring them. So it allows me to do something that I'm very passionate about, but also taking leadership development seriously as something to learn, as almost like a craft to learn, has served me well. I've been able to rise quickly because I had the right communication skills and I was delivering the results and I could delegate. So all those things about being a manager and a leader, you know, allowed me to quickly rise through the ranks.
That's awesome. We've talked a bit about your career. And I think what everyone's always curious about too is the real experience at MIT. And everyone's is so unique. And so I'm curious what you found to be some of the most impactful parts of MIT, or maybe some of the most important people you met along the way that really made your MIT experience unique and what it was.
Yeah, I think in terms of the curriculum, I think two things. One, the whole idea about being comfortable with your leadership story and your leadership journey. I mean, obviously, I took that so seriously that I wrote that I actually wrote a book about it, but it took me a really long time to even get comfortable sharing my challenges with my classmates. So that part. And then the other part of the curriculum is about analyzing organizations and understanding the cultural aspects and the process aspects and the political aspects. That has really served me well because, you know, I moved to a new organization fairly quickly, a very different type of organization. I would say I went from one that was very much a process focused. Roles and responsibilities are clear. Your job, if you can make improvements in the process, it's clear, to a much more cultural and political organization where it's much more about relationships and symbols and things like that. So if I hadn't had frameworks to think through that, I would be just completely lost at this point.
The three lenses. You got to love the three lenses.
Exactly.
That's awesome. And so we've talked about one of your more challenging career moments. I'm wondering if you could share maybe something that was one of the most impactful or positive things that's happened throughout your career that's really shaped who you are today.
Yeah, something that has really been a highlight and a pivotal moment for me was when my team decided to pitch a project for a company in Saudi Arabia. So there's a company that we were collaborating with, and they wanted to do some process improvements. And we had been doing that within our own company. And we thought, well, maybe we can sell this service to someone else. So we raised our hand and said, you know, we think we can do this. We want to try it. And we're very successful in doing that, which one was a new kind of a new business for us. Having the scientists sort of put together a package and sell it as technical services was something new for the organization. For me personally, I was the face of this project, and it was especially challenging for me as a woman because culturally, the dynamics for women in Saudi Arabia are very different than they are in the US. And in fact, the location that I needed to be at and where we were going to do this improvement process, I had to get special permission to even enter. The first time I was there to pitch the project, several of the attendees left because they didn't think it was appropriate for me to be the one presenting.
Wow.
There were no women's bathrooms, so I had to bring a sticker and stick it on a door and say, this is mine for the next couple of days. So to sort of win the project, win the business, have a huge win for the team, all while managing my own sort of personal challenges that were uniquely mine, because I was the only one on the team going through that, was a real highlight for me.
That's fantastic. It sounds like you managed it really well, but this was probably the first time you were ever in a situation like that.
Again, it was that military kid training, like, okay, here I am. I've got to figure this out.
Awesome. That's a good story. And that sounds like quite an accomplishment. You got the deal, and that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's great.
So your work brings out and highlights the fact that you are in a very male-dominated field, which I think is something that obviously a lot of women in STEM are really challenged with, and it's unique for each one of us. So I'm just curious, why do you think your book and your journey resonates so much with women? Like, what is the feedback that you're getting around this topic?
Yeah, the feedback, well, there's a couple of things. So I think women who are sort of mid to higher level are sort of really wanting to take my book or bring me in and just show it to their male colleagues and say, see, we've not been making this up, right? This is a real thing. And I think that more junior women are reading it and saying, wow, you know, it is possible. She's a role model. And really, which I'm thrilled to know, really taking the exercises seriously. So I've had many women contact me and want to talk to me, which I'm always happy to do. And then say, okay, you know, I just finished the Enjoy Dread list and I was just, you know, or I did the perfect day. It was really helpful. And so I think the fact that my book is actionable, contains actionable advice, is really also resonating.
That's excellent. And you mentioned that you've been giving a lot of speaking engagements. Like this month was the, what is this, Women's History Month.
Women's History Month, right?
Yes. So you've been drawn, because your book is fairly new. So
yes.
can you talk about some of those some of those kind of speaking engagements and maybe some of the advice that people are trying to pull out of you from these engagements?
Yes. So I have been on the speaking circuit. I did not plan it, but it was a great time to write a book about women and have that ready. I have primarily been focusing on two main aspects of it. One is how to overcome imposter syndrome. What do you recommend there? The other has been more career progression. What I have been doing is my main advice on overcoming imposter syndrome. I take the opportunity to say, okay, women, I'm going to give you specific advice, but since you invited me into your organization and we may have some male leaders here, let me take a step back and talk about what organizations can do as well to help women. So I say, leaders, you really need to make sure you're looking beyond the numbers of whatever diversity metrics I'm sure you all have, because you have to have them these days, but make sure you're really understanding how your diverse talent are feeling. What is their actual experience? Then I tell everyone to make sure they celebrate small wins. Somebody who's in innovation, I think that is critical. And it's been shown, researchers at Harvard have shown that the progress principle is a great way to increase employee engagement. So celebrating small wins. And then for the women themselves, I say, for me, the best way to overcome imposter syndrome is to really be very connected to the successes that you've had. And the way to do that is to write them down. So to develop the practice of actually writing down your accomplishments, what you did, why it was important to the organization, you know, what actual metrics you improved, and most importantly, to write down why that accomplishment was important to you. Because I think in the low points, when you have those low moments in your career, what will keep you going is if you have meaning in your work. And so, again, I think to don't try to just remember it when you're having a bad day, actually have your list and have the practice of updating it and reviewing it on a regular basis.
That's excellent advice. I think we tend to just kind of forget all the great stuff that we do. That's great advice. I think one thing that is also just super important that you mentioned at the top was actually the power of bringing men into the room for these conversations. I mean, me personally, I never joined women's groups because I found it more of, I felt like women just kind of coming together to complain, and without men being in the room to actually help us and be our advocates. I mean, in some cases, being a woman in STEM, they're actually our major champions most of the time because there's no other women around, right? I'm curious what role you see men playing and maybe some advice for them as they look to help their female colleagues moving forward.
I think it goes back to the shared empathy. I think that framing the discussion as men need to understand how hard it is for women and help them is not the most productive. What I would prefer to see is that men and women discuss the challenges that they both have, and then maybe we can pick some of the low-hanging fruit that if we fix will help everyone, and then we can go from there. Then we're sort of moving together towards a common goal. That's what I felt back when we were having that MIT meeting, and I didn't speak up because, same as you, I felt like it was women complaining, not only men not listening, but maybe even being shot down when they tried to raise some of their own experiences. So that's what I like to see happen, is I like to see shared empathy. And one easy place I find, particularly in the STEM environment, is technical career paths. So many organizations do a great job of telling people how you can progress as a manager, but not telling scientists how they could progress as a scientist. And so that's a shared frustration across genders. And so if an organization works on that, that can often improve all of their people in STEM's view about their work, their own passion and excitement about progressing. So that's an example, and actually something I'm working on right now in my own organization.
No, that's actually a really important thing to address. Scientists are often overlooked in terms of career progression.
Yes.
Because they're individual contributors. So that's excellent. Awesome. So we're going to pivot just a little bit and focus really a bit more on you, because you're just an awesome person out there from MIT and also in the scientific world. Do you have any daily habits that serve your well-being such that you are able to maintain and deliver at such a high level?
Yes. So one of the things that I do is I take a little note card and I write down my really important goals in life, you know, and it's like being connected with my kids and my husband and being reasonably healthy and things like that. So I have just sort of a practice. It's probably my version of journaling or that kind of thing. I do meditate daily. So I practice transcendental meditation. They want you to do it twice a day, but I've only ever managed to do it once. I would say within the last 2 years, I've really been trying to get the 7 hours of sleep. I had been one of those that just lived on coffee and melatonin because I switched time zones all the time. And then I read Why We Sleep and was scared and realized that I was damaging myself in quite a permanent way. So I would say that's a habit that I'm building, the sleeping. Yeah.
Sounds like a great book, Why We Sleep. I'm going to write that one down.
Highly recommend it. Yeah.
It's very good. And so how did you make these things a habit? You just decided, look, I've got to get in control of these things, or like what was the process for that?
Yeah, that's a good question. The writing down the things every day, I mean, I've been doing that for 10 years now, so I don't even remember how it happened, but it just did. And then the meditation, I actually started right before the program, just happened to do that, found a teacher. And then, yeah, the sleeping was really just recently, and I think it had to do with high blood pressure. Yeah, I was having some high blood pressure and, you know, just starting to get some of those health signals. And it was like, okay, you have to pay attention to yourself now. And the sleeping was really one of the things. I'm quite organized and regimented. So if I do something, if I say I'm going to do something sort of first thing in the morning, it will get done. So yeah.
We all find ourselves so busy these days, and I think actually probably even more so now that we're in this pandemic. So do you have any non-negotiables, like things that you will not give up or do just to keep yourself on track?
The meditation. It's been great because of the pandemic, they decided to have it like a Zoom meeting. And so it was one of those things where it's available every hour. So it doesn't have to be a certain time. But every hour it's available to just have somebody kind of talk you through it. So that's actually been easier due to COVID.
So meditation sounding like the winner
yes,
there.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
That's awesome. We at MIT Talks have something that we do here in terms of kind of our signature questions. But before we jump into that, I'm just really curious, one, about the next book that you're writing, because I think there's something on the horizon. Can you just give us a quick little preview of that?
Yes, I just launched today, actually, the call for interviews. So I am writing a book, You're More Than a Diversity Hire, Women in College Sports. I am co-authoring with my fellow MIT classmate, Amy Hutchhausen, who is an executive in the college sports industry. Yeah, we just opened up the call for interviews. So if anybody here is somebody in the college sports industry or knows someone, then they can reach out. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, Anjali, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an incredible conversation, and I've really enjoyed our time together. As we wrap up, we have just a couple of signature questions, and I'll start out with the first one. So what is one book that you think everyone should read?
I think everyone should read Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Giving In by Roger Fisher, William Ury, and Bruce Patton. And I say that because I think that, well, first of all, it's a great framework for negotiation, but I think people should be thinking about interactions with people as a negotiation much more often than they do. And so these frameworks can help. And I just had an example, just my kids. My daughter wanted to go to school early so that she could open up car doors with her classmates dressed in Greek mythology outfits. And so in order to do that, she had to convince older brother to get up early. And so I was like, okay, how are you going to manage that, Sophia? She's like, I said, let's brainstorm some ideas where you might be able to negotiate with him to make this work. So yeah, I think that there's some great frameworks. And if you think about a lot of life's interactions as potential negotiations and think about ways to solve them, that would serve a lot of us well.
That's excellent. Yeah, kids are great negotiators, actually, sometimes without frameworks. Great. And so the next one is, please use one word to describe your past, your present, and your future.
Happenstance, confident, and intentional.
Excellent. Excellent. So you're in this like very confident mode right now, and you're going to move on. Can you double click on the intentional a little bit? I'm curious for your future.
I have a plan more with, you know, expanding on the publishing side of things. Really, my vision is to have these books really covering all of the underserved people that are out there. So that's what I'm working towards. So I need more co-authors. So again, if any of your listeners want to co-author a book with me, that would be great.
That's great. Yeah. They can reach us at our outlets as well to get your contact information. And our last question, maybe our most interesting one, is would you rather have a library full of books or a contact list full of names?
Library full of books, hands down. I mean, I very much am an introvert. And it's probably more because I don't want to talk to the people and less because I want to read a lot of books. That's why I picked it. Certainly, this is changing because now I'm an author and I'm engaging people in a different way. It's more on my terms, I think, so rather than just kind of I'm not much of a like cocktail chit chatter. But books, certainly, I'm just a very curious person. And so I really enjoy reading both to learn, but also as a form of escapism.
Excellent. Wonderful. All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time on MIT Talks today. This has been an incredible look into your journey. I'm really excited to see the feedback we get from this and also wishing you the best of luck on your next book. And I'll be sure to pick that up as well. And you're listening to MIT Talks with interview from Angelique Adams. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us for another inspiring episode of MIT Talks.
We would love to hear from you, our listeners. Engage with us at MIT Club of Boston's website or any of our social media channels.
Please send us your ideas for future podcast guests or reach out to further the conversation with your awesome co-hosts.
Thank you for listening to the MIT Talks.